From WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. Well, it's happened. After knocking on the door of 20,000 for weeks, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has hit that historic milestone, which represents a gain of nearly 14,000 points over the last 8 years. What does this mean for people saving for a house, saving for a child's education, or saving for retirement? President Trump has promised to deregulate businesses, cut government spending, and cut taxes. Should his election change anything about our investment strategy? Today, a conversation about personal finance with Washington Post syndicated columnist Michelle Singletary. What steps should we take to make sure we're financially fit in the era of Trump? We'll take your calls, emails, and tweets. Personal Finance with Michelle Singletary coming up next on Midday. First, the news. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you're with us this afternoon for Midday. It's not unusual for the election of a new president to cause uncertainty in the stock market. On election night, when it became clear that Donald Trump would win the presidency, markets dropped sharply. But boy, have they bounced back. They've bounced back to record highs. Just this morning, the Dow Industrial Average topped 20,000 for the first time in history. So that's good news for investors, but some analysts worry that deregulation, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act without a substitute, or possible cuts to programs like Medicare could send the economy into a tumble. So what does all this mean to individual investors who are saving to buy a house or paying off student loans or saving for a child's education or planning for retirement? Michelle Singletary joins me now from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. to give us some tips on what we should be doing to manage our money during the Trump administration or, for that matter, any administration. Michelle Singletary writes the nationally syndicated personal finance column, The Color of Money, for The Washington Post. She's the author of three books, including The 21-Day Financial Fast, Your Path to Financial Peace and Freedom. Michelle, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad to be here because Baltimore is my hometown.
It is indeed. And my wife, Linnell, by the way, Linnell Smith, a colleague of yours at the Evening Sun, sends her regards.
Yeah. Oh, to her as well.
Okay. And you are welcome, folks listening to our program, to join our conversation with questions and comments about personal finance. 410-662-8780 is our email address, is our telephone number, our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Michelle, when President Obama was elected in November 2008, there were all sorts of predictions of doom and what that would mean for the financial markets. There were people saying that, you know, Governor Romney would have been much better for the stock market in 2012 than Mr. Obama. None of those predictions came true. What do you think the impact of Mr. Trump's election will be long term for the stock market? Are there historical measures that would lead us to any conclusions?
I think right now, because President Trump is such an anomaly, he's sort of made his own path that I don't think there isn't any historical data that would help us with his presidency. Mm-hmm. So I think that what most people should do is just keep doing what is always sound, no matter who is in the White House, which is to live below your means, save as much as you can, keep your debt as low, if to zero, as possible, you know, maybe with the exception of your mortgage, because many of us will carry that up until we retire, and just follow that smart path. You can't time the market even to a new president.
On election night, I was anchoring the coverage here at WIPR on election night, and as it became clear that Mr. Trump was going to prevail, we saw the markets just diving like crazy.
Yeah.
Can you explain why that happened, and then why it took so very little time for them to say, "Whoops, nope, no problem, we're good," and then it started this, you know, inexorable climb to today's record-breaking number?
I think part of the reason is that people just don't know what exactly he's going to do. There's one thing to campaign, but there, because he had no history of serving in office to sort of show us how he would act once he takes office, that people were nervous about what was going to happen. But, you know, again, you can't time the market. A lot of times what happens to the market, it's not clear why it would dip so low. And then as you report, it went right back up and it's been roaring ever since. Is that because of Trump? Maybe, maybe not. But we just don't know. And so that's why you can't panic. I had some readers who said, as soon as Trump was elected, I pulled all my money out. Well, look what happened since he was elected. And even now, you can look at the Dow, but that's not always, that's just 30 stocks of major companies. So you've got to look at the whole market and what's been going on. But had you pulled out of fear of a Trump presidency, you would have missed a lot of upside to the market that we've experienced recently.
Does it also matter that because President Trump is so unpredictable and unusual when it comes to the optics and the specifics of how presidents get their message out? The market obviously always responds to comments made by the president or comments made by the Fed chairperson or something like that. But those comments are made in press conferences. They are reported on often by reporters who, like you, cover the financial markets and cover this issue and so know it quite well. I mean, instead of that now, we're getting tweets. And we've already seen in the period between the election and the inauguration that some of at that point, the president-elect's tweets were moving markets and even becoming like crushing blows to particular companies or particular industries.
That's right.
Is the fact that he's obviously going to run this railroad a lot differently than it's been run in the past, what do you think that might do to the psychology of the people who are investing in the stock market?
I do think it'll make it dangerous because, many of the people in the market are saving for their retirement. And they're, for the most part, novice investors. Lots of us, and I'm not an experienced investor. I save for my retirement and my kids' college fund like everybody else in tax advantage products like the 401k and 529 plan. So even though what he may say doesn't have any basis in what companies will actually do, it will panic people. Shortly after he took office, President Trump said something like, the dollar's too strong. And then we saw some reaction in the market at that. So while I think we need to listen to what he's saying and how his policies play out, as regular folk, people plying money into your 401k and 529 plan, you have to somehow tune it out. Because you can't react on a day-to-day basis to these tweets and things that he says. I mean, today, even as I was driving in for this interview, there was talk about the building a wall and who's going to pay for it and how are you going to make, if Mexico doesn't pay for it, then the United States has to pay for it and where's that money coming from? We're already in debt. And you can see how it just will aggravate people. And I really hope that President Trump and his administration understands that there are a lot of worried people out there, people who voted for him and people who didn't vote for him. They're scared, and be very thoughtful and careful about what he tweets and says, because if he says something that panics someone and they pull their money out and they don't have that growth in their retirement, that very same person is going to need to rely on our government and government funds, which we already know is in trouble in terms of the Social Security system. So I just hope that they be very careful and not panic people. And many of them already scared about investing.
A lot of the reasons that people give for the uptick in the market have to do with the expectation that the market will be less regulated than it was during the Obama administration. People seemed to have their eye out for the Dodd-Frank Wall Street reform regulations. The Consumer Protection Act, which was passed in 2010, created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. What kind of deregulation could the Trump administration implement, and how might that affect the market?
Well, Don, to be honest, if I knew that, I'd be a very rich woman
now. Yeah, I suppose so.
I mean,
that's true.
I mean, you hate to sound like a broken record, but we do not know. He has no history of governing. And so whether or not his rhetoric turns into legislation, what, I mean, you know, let's take the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You know, if somehow that goes away, you know, that bureau, that agency was, that watchdog was created to protect, you know, consumers. So let's say that goes away and things go amok as it did during the crisis when companies were predatory and giving people loans they should have never gotten. So while their bottom line might be okay, the individual bottom line won't be, and that could cause a crash. So even if you deregulate and pull back on some of those regulations, if the bad players do bad things, that's going to hurt the individual consumer, and that could tank the market. So as you can see, you can't really say until he does, you know, a lot of what he said he was going to do. And I just hope that we keep in place the consumer protections that have helped consumers a great deal avoid being preyed upon.
You talk about how it's impossible to time the market. One of the sectors that has done particularly well since the election is the banking and financial services industry. And again, a lot of people say that it's because expected deregulation will help mm-hmm. that industry. It's also interesting that it's been reported that several of the top executives for some of these big firms like Morgan Stanley and Citicorp and stuff have divested themselves of their individual stock holdings. There are people who have, you know, sold, taken their options on stocks, you know, 200 right. shares of Morgan Stanley, the head of that, sold them, made a whole bunch of money doing it. And people are looking at that and saying, if these bank executives are unloading their shares of this sector that's done so well in these last 8-12 weeks, what does that mean? Is there a way of imputing any particular importance to individual moves by people who are highly invested in the stock market?
I'm not so sure there is, because it could. I mean, listen, the market's been doing, you know, great. And so they may have had a personal decision. Hey, if it hits a certain point, I'm going to take my profits. I'm going to take my returns. So you can't necessarily mean that they're bailing, knowing somehow that down the road, you know, banking is going to tank. It could just be that they're cashing in because mm-hmm. The market has done very well. And that's why you have to look at your own individual situation. Clearly, you need to watch what's going on. Clearly, you need to understand how, you know, a certain industry is doing. But, you know, banks are doing well. They're lending to folks. People are, you know, housing buys are up. People are selling and buying houses. And so that means that the stocks are doing well and people may be cashing out. But, you know, the flip side could come and things happen and people pull back. So look at what you need to do in the short term and long term. And if you're saving for retirement in the long term, you kind of got to wait out some of these things. If long as you are diversified, I say not just look at what you have in your investment portfolio, but also how you're handling your money in general, you know, keeping your debt as low to possible to zero, except for perhaps your mortgage, you know, living below your means, tightening your belt, even in good times, so that if something happens, you're not going to panic about your portfolio because your other money is doing well, and you can ride out, you know, when because the market will go down. It goes up, it goes down. And that's just how it's been since it's created. And so look at what you're doing for yourself. And that's the best way to kind of protect yourself.
So you're not going to suggest that folks pay particular attention to, you know, the fact that maybe Warren Buffett is taking a big position in this kind of industry or this particular company, or George Soros or Carl Icahn or any of these people that have, you know, gotten very wealthy investing in various ways in the stock market. We just need to sort of keep our eye on the ball here. It looks
right.
Like.
I mean, you certainly look at those moves, but again, are they just cashing out? Does that mean that they feel some? I mean, they don't know either what's down the road. That, I mean, if we look at what they're doing, that says that we know that they know what's going to happen, and they do not.
Michelle Singletary writes the nationally syndicated personal finance column called The Color of Money for the Washington Post and more than 100 other papers. She's also issued the No Debt, No Mess Color of Money Challenge, and we're going to talk about that when we come back after a break. You are welcome to join our conversation with Michelle Singletary. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. More on Your Money when we come back. Stay with us. And welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, on yesterday's show, we examined some of the ethical questions involved in physician-assisted suicide, also known as aid in dying. It's now legal in many states in the District of Columbia. I got a little update on that. We are told that legislators in Annapolis will reintroduce a death with dignity bill at some point during the current session. So if so, this will be the third attempt to pass such legislation in Maryland. And if approved, the legislation would set the parameters within which terminally ill adults could hasten their own death. We, of course, will stay on top of that and report to you details as they become available. Coming up tomorrow on the program, the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle joins us for Smart Nutrition. More and more people are turning to apps to help them manage their fitness, but are they really useful in the battle against the bulge? Monica will take your questions, and theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Beautiful, the Carole King musical at the Hippodrome Theater. If you're just joining us today, it's the Finance Diva. We're talking personal finance with my guest, Michelle Singletary. She's a personal finance coach who writes the nationally syndicated column The Color of Money for the Washington Post. She's also the author of three books. Her latest is The 21-Day Financial Fast, Your Path to Financial Peace and Freedom. And Michelle, you have issued on your website and on your Twitter feed the No Debt, No Mess Color of Money Challenge. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, at the beginning of the year, lots of us make promises to ourselves, you know, lose weight, you know, work out more. And one of the top three resolutions is always about money. And so yearly, I try to come up with a different challenge. Last year was based on my book, The 21-Day Financial Fast, where for 21 days, you can't spend any money that is not a necessity. But this year, I wanted to just do something a little different. And I was cleaning out an area in my house, and I thought, man, I've got a lot of clutter. You just collect things and can't let go. And I thought, you know, this is a lot like people in debt. You get to a point where it's so much that you don't even think that you can ever get rid of it. So you push it to the side, you hide it, you just pay the minimum payments, and it just hangs around like a pet. And so I wanted to have people clean the clutter from certain parts of their dwelling and also clear the clutter in their debt. And so I've been posting videos of my clutter. I opened up my home and showed people my hot mess, you know, in your kitchen. Tom, I bet you got one of these. You got a cabinet, open it up and stuff just falls out.
And you shot this video in your storage area and you can see all this stuff sitting right behind your head.
I know, it's so embarrassing. And then I had a packet drawer. You know, y'all have a packet drawer. Some people call it the junk drawer. You just throw stuff in there and it gets buried, and it was a hot mess. And then my home office, because I mostly work from home, and that was terrible. Piles of paper. I have never seen a paper that I can't get rid of, that I hold on to. And now for me, you know, I'm a good money manager. But for me, holding on stuff had a lot to do with the way I grew up. I was raised by my grandmother. So, you know, I was, you know, essentially abandoned by my parents. And so I have this sense of abandonment. And so I can't get rid of stuff, because what if I need it? Because, you know, I was thrown away. And so, you know, that's sort of a psychological thing, because a lot of money problems aren't really about the money. It's about all the stuff that in your head. And so while you're clearing away the clutter, I want people to equate that to clearing away credit card debt or getting rid of that student loan aggressively. So I was cleaning up stuff and showing people how to clean up stuff in their their actual house and their financial house. And it's been a great response from people. And even if you didn't start at the beginning of the year, you can jump in at any time. It's a 3-week challenge. You go the first week, I call it assess the mess. Go through your house, pick out a couple spots. Don't try to do the whole house. So I've picked 4 locations, the cabinet with the containers, the package drawer, my home office, and a closet where I kept all the games for my kids. And my youngest kid is 16 years old. And that closet has their baby blankets. And then the next week is reduce the redundancy. And the last week is lighten your load. So if you go on the Washington Post website and put in hashtag no debt, no mess, you'll see the whole challenge. And I tell you, it's been very eye-opening for me and a lot of people.
And you have folks, you know, who are sending you videos of their houses and the clutter that they've gotten rid of. That's really an interesting thing. I'm very, very taken with this notion that emotional clutter influences how we handle money. Physical clutter can influence how we live our lives, ergo how we handle money. I mean, money, as you say, is related to a lot more things than just the, you know, the data-driven business of what our debt is and what our obligations are and what the stock market may be. It's a lot more
Absolutely.
Than that. It goes a lot deeper, doesn't it?
It's so deep. And you began the session talking about the markets and all that, but most of what people deal with on a day-to-day basis isn't what's happening in the market. That's important. But the reason why they don't have the money to even invest is because they've got so much financial clutter. You know, their bills are in shopping bags because they can't deal it. You know, I deal with people who come to me when I help them with their budget. They haven't even opened up their mail. I met with a woman one time and her lights were about to be turned off the next day because she couldn't bear to open up the envelope from the utility company. You know, couples fighting about money. You know, parents who can not say for their kids to go to college because there's so much stuff going on. They want to buy stuff and clutter up their homes instead of taking that money and putting it in a college fund. So, you know, in order to be a better money manager, you got to start with your head, you know, what's in your head and not necessarily a budget template. Because if I don't get you to buy in that you need to do some stuff, I can give you $1 million and you'll lose it in no time at all.
Michelle Singletary of the Washington Post. If you've got some clutter that you could get rid of and if you've got ways that you could clean up your financial clutter, give us a call and share them with us. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. For folks that are lucky enough to be able to have a little bit left over after the basic bills are paid and they can invest, what's your opinion about the growing trend to not having anybody manage the money, but simply put it in an index fund, which is tied to the overall performance of the stock market? What's interesting about some of the people who are supporting this financial strategy, they include this guy, Jack Bogle, who was the guy who's credited with sort of inventing the index fund, inventing this method of investing for the Vanguard funds. Then, of course, there are, you know, all these different companies that offer their expertise with various mutual funds that invest in certain things, you know, international stocks or domestic stocks, big companies, little companies, bond funds, that kind of stuff. And there are folks who say, you know, you don't need any of that. Just throw it all in the index fund. We all rise or fall based on how the market overall is doing. What's your take on that?
I think for the average investor, that's the good advice because, you know, they've done studies and showed managed funds versus index funds, and pretty much they perform the same. There's not wild string. It's not like managed funds outperforms like 10 to 20%. In some instances, it does. But for the average investor, I think an index fund and, you know, do dollar cost averaging, which means every month you put a little bit in there and then you're buying the market at the highs and the lows and it sort of all evens out. Because, you know, it takes a lot of time to manage a big portfolio, and most people aren't going to do that. And also, you have to watch the cost. You know, managed funds cost more, and the fees that you pay have a direct impact on your return. So if you can get in a low-cost index fund, you're going to make out just fine. Because here's the number one reason to invest, the number one reason. And when I ask this to people when I'm doing speaking engagements and talking to people in my church, and I say, what's the number one reason to invest? And inevitably, they say, oh, you know, financial freedom, I want to retire early. They say all these things. I said, the number one reason to invest is a word called inflation. You want to be able to have your money by tomorrow, what you need. And so, you know, prices go up, so you've got to have your money grow. And if you can beat inflation and then some, you're going to do okay. So if you're not reaching for the stars and you know, the more risk you take, the higher the risk is, you know, when you get into risky things. So you want to just a basic thing, just basic, keep pace with inflation and hopefully a little bit better than that. And that's all you need. And I'm a big, big fan of index funds. It is how I invest myself. And I generally don't say where, because, you know, you don't want to encourage people. You should do your own research. But that's how I invest. And I'm telling you, it's paid off for me and my husband. We've been able to save for our kids' college fund. They won't go with any debt. We've done really well with our retirement funds and just that philosophy.
And even on a day like today, where the S&P and the Dow are really high, if today happens to be the day that you make your normal monthly investment in a fund, you'd go ahead and do it. You wouldn't wait for the market to go down.
Right. I just put a certain amount. My husband and I have decided we put a certain amount in the kids' college fund. We put a certain amount in our retirement plan. We also have an outside index fund that we put money into. And we every month it's automatic. We don't even think about it. We don't change it depending on what's going on in the market. When the market is down, that's like a sale. So we get more for our money. When it's up, we buy less. But that's OK. Sometimes you have to buy stuff retail. And that's how we done. And it has served us well. But as I said before, the key to all of this is on the other side, we are keeping our costs low. We live below our means. We don't have a lot of debt. You know, we buy cars with cash. So we do on the other side so that we're not so much more worried about what's in our investments. Because by the time we retire, we will not have a mortgage. And if that's 30 to 40% of your household expenses, that's going to set well for us in our retirement.
410-662-8780 to join the conversation with Michelle Singletary about managing our money. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, if you want to drop us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. Steve sends us an email, and he has two questions for you, Michelle. The first is, where is the best place to keep savings that is liquid and safe? And if you have a mortgage with a very low rate, should I pay the mortgage down with mutual fund investments that are already earning 8 to 12% a year? So two different questions. Mm-hmm. If you have money that is liquid and safe, in other words, not all of your money perhaps would be invested in the stock market, which mm-hmm. In order to get access to that money, you have to sell the stock, and sometimes you would owe taxes on that and that
right.
kind of stuff.
Right.
Where, given the fact that interest rates have been so low now for years mm-hmm. and years, mm-hmm. Where's the best place to park some money that's not in the stock market or the bond market?
So for your emergency money, your rainy day fund money, you are going to just park it in a regular deposit account. You can do a deposit savings account, a money market, or, you know, a CD. You can ladder CDs. So you buy, you know, like a 5-year CD, maybe a 2-year CD, 1 year, 6 months, 3 months, and so forth. But you do want to keep it liquid. And that means, you know, yeah, you're going to have pitiful, you know, interest rates. But that's okay, because that money has a different purpose. That's not your grow money. That's your, I lost my job. I got sick. I had to take, you know, more time, sick time than I have. I need to use this money to pay, you know, my expenses. So you got to think about this pot. This pot, that's your safety money. It's not going to grow. It is what it is. And just put it in a, you know, FDIC insured account. If you want to try to eke out a little bit more interest, you can go to bankrate.com. They, you know, have all, you know, banks that have the best interest rates, and you can sort of search around. But I don't even worry about that, because the difference is so little that I just put it in the regular banks I have. I have a regular bank account and a credit union account, and I keep my emergency money in those two accounts. I don't even worry about the fact that it's getting pitiful interest. And then I concentrate on, you know, investing in other words. Now, what about paying down your home? I truly believe that you should not drag a mortgage into retirement. And my husband and I make extra mortgage payments to principal every month. We are not pulling money out of our mutual funds or our retirement account because that's a pot for retirement. I'm a big believer in pots. So you've got your emergency fund pot. You've got your retirement pot. You got your pot for paying your mortgage down. And so you cut expenses elsewhere and use that money to apply to your principal because you don't want to be in a situation where your house rich and cash poor at retirement, meaning all your money is in your paid off house. So you do need cash to live in retirement. So if you can, leave that retirement pot alone and do what you can to cut expenses to add to your principal mortgage payment to pay that down.
And folks sometimes don't realize that you can do that. You send in your mortgage payment once a month, but you can also send in additional checks and just mark on the check, apply to principal or something
Absolutely.
To that effect. And that will not be paying for the interest. It will be paying just for the principal so that, over time, your interest payments and your interest obligation will go down. So that's good advice. But generally speaking, holding on to a mortgage, even though the mortgage rates these days are still pretty low, it's a good idea to speed up the time that you can pay off that loan eventually.
I do. Absolutely. I think more and more seniors are taking mortgages into retirement. I mean, there used to be a day, I might be dating myself a little bit, but, they had mortgage burning parties where people were celebrating that they understood the principle of not taking a mortgage into retirement. And my grandmother taught me this principle. She'd pay a little bit extra. Now that it's so electronic, when we make our automatic mortgage payments, there's a line right there. Okay, what's your, regular payment? And down here, apply to principal. And we have knocked several years off of our mortgage so that we can retire it and save a ton in interest. And that's how we've been doing it. And if you can't afford that, make one extra mortgage payment a year. Do whatever you can because that's going to help you reduce that over time.
How about the calculation for a young person who is thinking about buying a house? She's paying the rent every month, but that rent is not building any equity. The interest rates are low, but of course there are a lot of expenses associated with a house that you don't have when you're renting. And, if your bathroom blows up, it's the landlord's problem. It's not yours. How do you come to a determination whether or not now is the right time to start investing in a house as opposed to paying rent?
I love that question because I get it all the time, especially in this low interest rate mortgage market and, housing prices had come down, although they're starting to go up. I tell people the same thing, whether they're old or young. The right time to buy the house is the right time to buy the house. And I have them tick off some things. So if you're a young person, I don't think you're ready to buy a house if you got student loan debt. Get rid of all of that student loan debt. Every dollar of it. You're not ready to buy a house. If you've got credit card debt, pay it all off. Now this is going to be way out there. I understand people are probably going to, bust into your studio. If you got a car loan, pay that off. Go into that house with zero debt. Also go into that house with 6 months, 3 to 6 months, but 6 months ideally, of living expenses. What does it take? What would it take based on the mortgage you think you're going to get? Save that and utilities and all the stuff to run your household in that house. Save that up for 6 months. Then I want you to have what I call a life happens fund. That's if your car breaks down or something happens, so you don't have to rob your emergency fund. And I, for a young person, probably $2,000, maybe $3,000 in that pot. Then if you can tick all those things off and the mortgage is not going to take up more than 30%, 30, 35, 36%, no more than that of your net pay, you're ready to get a house.
So that's a big chunk of change there. If you're talking about paying off your student loan, paying off your car, having enough to pay a down payment on the house that you're going to need to do to get in, and then paying off or paying in advance yourself to be sure that you have money to cover expenses. So you're really recommending that folks go into home ownership with no debt other than the home itself.
Absolutely. And I know that's radical. I know some people listening right now, what is wrong with this child? but here's why I say that. Because I have the benefit, the pleasure, the unfortunateness of seeing people who do it, who run into home ownership, and they've got all that debt, and now they've got too much house. And if anything happens, any disruption, any illness, any layoff, any pullback on their money, it all comes crashing down. And so I see that constantly. And I tell you, so I know those numbers are big, and what I just said seems impossible. So as a young adult coming out, this is what I suggest. So I suggest don't get an apartment. Go live with someone. Live with your parents until you can save up. Live with a relative. Get 10 or 15, you know, roommates so that you are, you know, powering that money up so that when you walk into that house, you can breathe, right? You know?
All right, Michelle, now you got all the parents mad at you, too. They said, oh, no, not that, anything but that.
You know, and I hear you, but you know, there was a time where we had multi-generational homes, and we didn't kick our kids out when they turned 18 or 21. Why? I told my daughter, who's about to graduate from University of Maryland College Park, and she's going to go to grad school. I actually told her, I said, I want you to come home after grad school and spend the time saving up. We're not going to charge you rent. Save all that rent money so that in 2 to 3 years, because if she took her entire paycheck, aside from some small, you know, incidentals and personal stuff, for 2 to 3 years, she would have all that money I just told you about.
Right.
And she said to me, Mom, I'm going to do that if that's okay with you. Absolutely, baby. But listen, as a parent, I'm going to be watching her savings account. I want to make sure that she's putting that money away. That, and then when she walks out my door, she's gone, right? And I'm happy about that. She won't come back. Don't kick them to the curb right away. Let them stay there and build up some reserves so that, hey, they don't have to come back. I don't want them to come back.
Michelle Singletary writes the nationally syndicated Color of Money column for the Washington Post. We'll have more financial tips from Michelle and more of your calls, emails, and tweets, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Lots more on your money when we come back after a break. Stay with us.
La, 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 wait till I give my money right. I had a dream I could buy my way to heaven. When I awoke, I spent that on a necklace. I told God I'll be back in a second. Man, it's so hard not to act reckless. To whom much is given, much is tested. Get arrested, guess until he get the message. I feel the pressure under more scrutiny. And what I do, act more stupidly. Bought more jewelry, more Louis V. My mama couldn't get through to me.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we're talking about managing your money with Michelle Singletary, who writes a nationally syndicated personal finance column for The Washington Post. Her latest book is called The 21-Day Financial Fast, Your Path to Financial Peace and Freedom. She has also issued what she calls the No Debt, No Mess Challenge, Color of Money Challenge, which you could find out more about on The Washington Post website. So, Michelle, in this 21-day financial fast that you recommend to folks, that's another rather radical suggestion for folks, because to get to the point where you've got enough money to be able to, you know, invest or pay off your student loans or that kind of thing, you've got to make sure that that you're not overspending. And you suggest a 3-week program to really radically reduce your expenses. What kinds of expenses are you talking about?
So for the 21 days, you pay all your normal bills, your rent, you know, credit card bills, you do all the stuff you're supposed to, but you can't go eat out, can't go to the movies, can't get your hair done, no, you know, expensive coffee, not you, everything is shut down. You can't go to the mall, everything like that is shut down. And I tell you, people, the first day people are like, yeah, I can do this. The second day people have starts to have shakes, you know, because yeah. We spend so much of our time thinking about stuff that we want to buy or need to buy or, you know, and it really makes people, it forces them to think about, are you using your money for the things that you say or believe is of value to you? And when you look at how you're spending your money, does it reflect your values? dollars. If you want to send your kids to college debt free, are you saving? Are you putting money into a college fund, or are you taking vacations and spend your weekends at the mall or eating out a lot? You know, I'm a tither. I believe in tithing to my church. So that's the first thing my husband and I do with our money. We give it away. That's a value for us. And so I want people to spend the time to think about, are you putting your money, you know, that really means something to you? Because when I close my eyes for the last time on this earth, I want to know that my hard labor was for something. Right? I have 3 children and I want them to graduate with no debt.
Which is an incredible gift to give to your children.
It's an incredible gift. 2 of my kids want to go into education. And while you can earn a good, decent living, in some cases a good living, it may not be the same as a doctor or lawyer, but the way I've taught them and the fact that I've given them the gift of no debt for college, they can go into education and not have that financial pressure. You know, and so that's really what the fast is about. So you read the book, and every day there's a different challenge. You know, I talk about, you know, if you're married, dealing money with your spouse or help with your kids and family and saving and investing. I mean, it's a day by day look at your money and the big picture. Because at the end of the day, I just want people to have financial peace. You know, I mean, I want you to be able to breathe and not when the phone rings, you just cringe because it's another creditor, or the bills come and you buckle over, or it's time to send your kids to college and they got to take on debt and you have to take on debt, or it's time for you to retire and you're so worried. You're worried about living because now we live so far into our retirement, 20 and 30 years, that when it comes time retirement, you're like, I'm not going to die, you know? And you have this sense of dread.
And of course,
I don't want that for people.
And of course, coming up with that magic number of what you need when you're retired. You know, there are folks, and you've written about this. You had a column a week or so ago about it's possible that people are being scared into not savings because they hear that, oh, you have to have $1 million or $2 or $3 million, which is, you know, just an outrageous goal for a lot of people. But that shouldn't scare people away from starting. I mean, as the Talmud says, I think, you know, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step.
A single step. Absolutely. Certainly you want to try to have as much as you can. But at the end of the day, lots of people will not be able to have that. No matter what they do, no matter how much they cut, let's just be real. You know, the average income in the United States is around $50,000 for a family of 4. Who can save $1 million or $2 million? And you're trying to, you know, raise kids and live in a decent neighborhood and take a couple vacations and all that time. So what I tell people is what I learned from my grandmother, Big Mama, raised me in Baltimore, in a row house in Baltimore. She retired with her mortgage paid off, no debt, a living below her means, and $20,000 in the bank. $20,000. When she passed away 20 years later, she had $20,000 in the bank because she lived a good life, right? But she knew how to live below her means. And so you can retire with less than $3 million, but you got to do some stuff now, right? It could be that you can't have a house by yourself. It might be that you have to live with someone. It might be that you can't take a vacation every year like everybody else. And maybe you're going to keep your car for 10 or 15 or 20 years. But that's okay if you can have some security in retirement and you can live a long time without having to worry about buying groceries and things like that. So I'm not in the business of scaring people because I think that does them no good. I am in the business of telling you and asking you, as you listen to me in this program, what are you doing with your money? Does it align with your values? And if not, what are you going to do about it? And if you can't make do with what you have, then you're going to have to do something different.
Michelle Singletary from The Washington Post, 410-662-8780 is our number here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. I have a few other questions coming in, Michelle, about student loans, but I want to shift now to a question that comes from Who's this come from? Well, it comes from an unidentified Twitter person, Steve Reno, it looks like. What kind of diversification mix does Michelle recommend for people in their mid-60s who are approaching retirement, the folks who are closer rather than further away from retirement?
Right. Well, Michelle won't recommend anything for individuals because she's not a financial planner. But what I say is that this is what I will tell you, is that it used to be that you would back away from the markets because now you're close to retirement and you don't want to risk your money. But the fact that you're going to probably live we're living until our mid 80s and many people to their 90s. You need some growth. So you don't want to pull all your money out and just have it in bonds or a savings account. So you do need a mix. You do need to have some money in the market, but you need to have a pot that is not at risk. And so some advisors say, maybe 5 years worth of money that is not in some sort of, highly exposed to the market. And then the rest of the money, you might have it exposed. You have stocks and bonds. And then you want to look at different asset classes. So you might have large cap stocks, which are large companies, mid cap, small cap, and some international.
But the bottom line is you got to mix it up. You got to mix it up,
right? Because you're going to still have 20 years in retirement and you need to still have that money grow.
Right. Let's try to get to a couple of calls. I probably won't get to everybody, but we'll get to as many as we can. Gloria in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with personal finance columnist Michelle Singletary.
Hello, Ms. Singletary. Thank you for taking my call today. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, thank you. I am a 34-year-old woman out of Baltimore, Maryland, and I am going into the military, the Air Force, under the Trump administration. My question to you is, how does a young person like me, who has never technically owned a home, prepare to buy a home with being as though that I may be deployed or moving from state to state serving my country? How do I prepare to buy a home years from now?
So you don't want to buy one while you're deployed, right? You want to wait, right? Is that what you're saying?
I do want to wait, but do I have to wait until I'm out of the military, or is it possible, would it be wise for me to buy one while still in the military?
I think if you know that you're going to be moving around a lot, I would wait. Because what if you're not going to decide to stay in that area? You say you're deployed to Texas, but you really want to live in Maryland. So you buy a home in Texas because, people tell you to buy a home, but you don't want to live in Texas. And then you've got this home that you may or may not be able to sell. And if you don't sell, you got to have renters in it and you got to manage it. I would just wait. And so while you're in the military and hopefully in some housing that they provided, and I know they give you a stipend, save as much as you possibly can.
Yeah, that could be a really good opportunity to stash some away. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Realize this. I want you to listen to me. You are not a financial failure if you are renting. You do get some money. You do get something for that money. You get a roof over your head. So if all of you who are listening who are renting, you are not like somehow, oh my gosh, I'm not doing the right thing. Because all of us who own homes know that you still have to put out a whole lot of money when you own a home. And if you don't do it right, you don't necessarily save as much as people think you do. So just wait. And most importantly, thank you for your service.
Indeed.
And just wait to buy the home when you're finished.
Indeed. Gloria, and I have one word for you when it comes to owning a home: roofer.
Right.
Think about that. I mean, that could be a pretty expensive proposition. Let's try to sneak in a couple more calls here. Christian in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Michelle Singletary.
Hello. I'm calling because I actually work with property. I'm a property manager, and I spend a lot of my time making sure that all of the little things in condos, like roofs, are paid for and taken care of. And I have had, let's see here, I'm not sure I'm allowed to tell you the specific number, but I've had a decent number of young people and young couples get foreclosed on out of units that I manage because they, think, oh, I'm going to own a home. This is going to be, this is the next step. And then they can't keep up with their condo payment, they can't keep up their mortgage payment, they can't manage having a full-time job and keeping all of their ducks in a row. So it's always a little bit better to err on the side of caution. Like from someone who does this for a living, please wait until you have
right.
all of your finances in order and your life in order, and then move on to homeownership.
Great. Thank you for that call, Christian. We're running out of time, so I'm going to let you go now. But, Michelle, this is simply backing up what you said. Wait until
Absolutely.
You've got the money in hand before
yep.
you do, because if you're doing a student loan and a car loan and a mortgage payment on a condo, that just may eventually become too much to handle. And Christian,
it's too much.
Christian's experience is that that's in fact
I love it. Yeah. I love it when people co-sign on what I said. That's yeah. Although, don't ever co-sign. I'm just saying.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for your time. We will have you back as soon as possible, because this is stuff that lots of folks give lots of thought to, and you write and think so thoughtfully about it. So I appreciate it, and we will
thank
talk you. To you next time. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thank you.
Michelle Singletary writes the nationally syndicated personal finance column The Color of Money for The Washington Post. She's the author of three books, including The 21-Day Financial Fast, Your Path to Financial Peace and Freedom. We'll have a link to the No Debt, No Mess Color of Money Challenge on our website, wypri.org/midday. Coming up tomorrow here on Midday, the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, will join us to dispel a few myths about carbs and fat and stuff like that. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review of Beautiful, the Carole King musical at the Hippodrome Theater. Thanks to Dangerously Delicious Pies for providing lunch today. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street on the avenue in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. We're out of here. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.